Welcome to the SICK Network Podcast, a weekly podcast discussing current and topical issues affecting SICKs across the global diaspora.
Hi and welcome to the SICK Network Podcast. You join us for episode 21. And, you know, like every episode is, but particularly this episode is very, very significant as you join us on Bisaki weekend. That's exactly what we're going to be talking about today. The significance of Bisaki, the manifestation of the Khalsa, and obviously the historical significance of that, as well as the significance that we see today with everything that's going on in Punjab. So thanks and welcome to all the viewers for listening in. I think it's a good opportunity to just to remind everyone to, you know, look at our libraries on all the major podcast platforms and have a look through, you know, the previous 20 that we've done. Really appreciate all the support that we've had so far. You know, it's been really, really strong figures. So yes, episode 21, Bisaki. Again, joined by SICK Network podcast regulars, Jaz Singh and Mankamal Singh, but also today, delighted to be joined by prominent Sikh commentator, Sukhbir Singh. Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa, Waheguru Ji Ki Fateh. So, Kabir, thanks for joining us today, and you know, really appreciate that, and you know, be really interesting to get your insight on some of these things as we go through the podcast today. Mankamal, if we start with you today, you know, really significant. You know, we all find ourselves here on Bisaki weekend, and kind of it helps everyone kind of really look at what Bisaki is all about and understanding and re-remembering the significance and what it really means. So I suppose from a broad perspective, Mankamal, you know, do you want to just give us your insight into that and kind of how this plays into the modern world, really?
Yeah, I mean, I won't talk too much about it because I think lots of other podcasts would already cover the history and the relevance of Bisaki. I mean, in short, Bisaki is a harvest festival that goes back, you know, many millennia in the region in North India, but was used specifically by Guru Sahiban as a gathering, and not just by Guru Gobind Singh Ji, but before Guru Gobind Singh Ji, we've got historical references, I think dating back to even Guru Amar Das, where we had gatherings at Bisaki and Diwali, as they were well-known sort of calendar dates within Indic tradition. It would have been probably, you know, it would have made logical sense to ensure that we had gatherings of Sangat during that time, especially with logistical, you know, the whole logistical exercise that we would have had in order to get people together. So in 1699, you know, Guru Sahib, Guru Gobind Singh Ji, you know, used Bisaki to bring that huge gathering together. I mean, there's some references that say up to 80,000 you know, turned up on that day from the Sikh Panth at the time, the Sikh community at the time, and gathered at Anandpur Sahib on that day on Bisaki. And Guru Sahib revealed to us the Khalsa. So it's very important we say reveal rather than creation, because references in Gurbani and references from other Granths as well always talk about a revelation, you know, Pargatio, and words like that are used as opposed to creation. So it was, you know, revealed to us. Now, if we look at the etymology of Khalsa and the you know, the history of the word Khalsa, you know, Khalsa comes from Arabic, Persian meaning, and it literally means pure. That's the Khalsa literal translation. But there's also, I think this is an unknown fact, and I came across this a few years back, but the word Khalisa was also used by the Mughal state, and it was used in administration terminology, and it was used for reference to land and lands held by the Mughal state themselves, by the sovereign. So again, you know, if you use the play on words, Khalsa was sort of used in that way as well. You know, that say that we are now sovereign. Guru Gobind Singh Ji put that out saying, you know, us as people now, we are sovereign. You know, we are going to take control of our own destiny, our own lands. You know, we will become our landlords. And under that structure, you know, we were basically laborers of the Khalsa, you could say, of the bigger infrastructure. So, you know, we've got to look at it like that as well, from that angle. So, you know, on that day, we saw the formation of the Khalsa. We saw the unique identity. We saw our unique lifestyle revealed to us. The Panjpyare specifically coming forward, and the symbolism of them giving their heads, which is basically what we still, till this day, use as symbolism, where we're giving our head, our intellect. You know, we're asking for the guru's intellect. So we give our head and, you know, we sacrifice our head in that way. And that still carries on in tradition through the symbolism of us taking Amrit. The Amrit was prepared. You know, another thing to just touch on the Amrit was that this whole Amrit was a bata, a bowl of you know, sweet sugared water with Gurbani, Gurbani and Akhanda used in preparation. But it brought all those castes together, and that's a powerful message that we still have to ensure that we hold in terms of breaking those barriers. And it was so controversial at the time that, you know, the Rajputs and some of the Khatri rulers at the time thought it was hugely controversial that, you know, they had to share a bata. If they wanted to take Amrit, they had to share a bata with people from, you know, the other castes, the lower castes. So again, you know, breaking that whole mold as well that had existed in that part of India. And then, well, not that part of India, the whole of India. And then we go to the unique identity, you know, the star standing out, the crown on our head, you know, again, the star, the turban, a sign of aristocracy, a sign of royalty and dignity. Again, you know, given as an identity to everyone, egalitarian identity to everyone who became part of the Khalsa. And the unique Panj Kakar, the 5 Ks that we have, which we'll talk in a bit more. In a bit more depth, but I don't know if anyone else wants to come in on this, Jazz. If I've missed anything, you want to?
Yeah, and I think you sort of highlighted the key part of this was around the Sikh identity and equality. And it's important to understand why the Sikh identity was necessary. Because if you go back, whilst Guru Gobind Singh Ji sort of really personified and illustrated the submission of a Sikh to his guru by calling for a head, a cease. And since then, we've always said that the Jairavi Sikh, you give your head to the Qaum, to the Panth, to the guru before you do anything else. But that was always from Guru Nanak Dev Ji. He said straight from day one that to walk on this path, you need to give your life and your head to the guru. And ultimately, what that means is you submit yourself. Everything you're being, your own ego, your own internal thought process and mind, body, and soul, is that you submit it to the guru and you work and you strive your life to serve the guru, not yourself. And what we had all the way through the lives of the gurus was how Sikhi adapted and the journey of Sikhi to evolve, and through all of the Nanaks up to Guru Gobind Singh Ji, as really what was this journey of a Sikh, because they were always learning and always moving. And it was from the Shemeh Pasha, Sri Guru Hargobind Sahib, where after 5 Nanaks' lives in the light, and in Guru Arjan Dev Ji's Shahidi, which is the first Shahidi of our Guru, that just being peaceful wasn't enough. If faith and belief is to survive, you have to be able to defend against oppression and tyrants who choose to target that. And that's when Guru Hargobind Sahib wore the Tukar Panna Miri Impiri. And then you get the Shahidi of Guru Tegh Bahadur Maharaj, the 9th Guru, in that he gave his head not to defend Sikhi, but to defend the Hindu faith from Mughal force conversions. So here is, and I think it's the one and only story you'll find where a religious leader, preacher has given his own life in sacrifice to save another religion. And from then on, then you see after the beheading in Delhi in Seez Ganj, the people scattered. And when Guru Gobind Singh, the nine-year-old Guru Gobind Singh, asked, where were the Sikhs of the Guru at the time? And he goes, the answer was, we couldn't see them. And they'd all scattered. And it's from then on that that was instilled, that he would create a Khalsa with an identity that would be spottable in one in a million. And I think that's where the identity comes from. Actually, it has a purpose, whether the star, the dara, even those things were respected, and all the gurus adopted it and the gursikhs adopted it. It was absolutely sort of personified and mandated, if you like, and ordained through the Khalsa and the Amrit Sanchar that was first done by Guru Gobind Singh Ji. So all of these things had a purpose. And when you talk about the equality aspect of it, that's really important, because if you talk about India back then, or as a sub-region, there was huge inequality and discrimination. And there's still, you could argue there still is today in modern India. And from a Sikhi perspective, it was to do away with all of that and absolutely separate Sikhs from any other faith and any other community. And it was unique in the fact that not only could all people from all castes, backgrounds, color, creed take Amrit, but also females and males equally. And this was putting everybody on that equal platform, that once you take Amrit, you should change your name to Singh and Kaur. Therefore, nobody could distinguish what was your background, because historically it was your surnames. Family surnames would be your identifier as to what Jat, whether social class or the Hindu sort of caste system, where you were from. And to do away with that, there would be no identification. Your physical identity would be the same, and your name would be of that of the Khalsa. So
that accessibility as well that Guru Sahib showed us in terms of accessibility to defending yourselves, in terms of arms, you know, the accessibility to spirituality and education, and uplifting yourselves in that manner as well. And even in the change in names, you know, from the use of the word Singh, for instance, these are all very exclusive prior to the revelation of the Khalsa. You know, the Singh surname was very much associated with the Rajput clan. So, you know, again, you could only be from that class. So that shattered their whole monopoly that they had on using the word and the name Singh. You know, access to arms, again, was only within the Kshatriyas, the Khatris, or you know, people who were under the Mughal army. So again, he armed the common person and said, you've got access to, you know, military weapons. And then also, you know, access to education. You know, we our Guru Sahib, you know, developed the script, Gurmukhi script, access, you know, Gurbani, everything, so that the common person did not have to rely on those classes, the Brahmin classes, in order to understand scripture or to believe that they need to have them fashion their whole lifestyle. So all these things, you know, are so important to understand where we are now, which we take so for granted in this day and age. But those things were huge game changers in the landscape of Punjab at that time.
No, and if you look at the Panch Pyare themselves by Daya Singh Ji, which is compassion, the virtues and the values of the Panch Pyare, I mean, they're so important, so significant. By Taram Singh Ji, it is all about righteousness. You've got by Himmat Singh Ji, it's about courage and strength. By Morkum Singh Ji, is being steadfast. By Sahab Singh Ji, about majesty. And you bring all those five together, and those virtues and those values, that's what signifies the Panj Pyare. And the concept of the Panj is consistent all the way through the Panj Kakar, Panj Singh, Panj Baniya, and wherever you, and this is the importance of Panj Singh today, wherever there's an issue or we have a Panthak struggle or you have a personal issue, you call Panj Singh and you take their guidance and their steer, and they will take steer from Guru Granth Sahib Ji Maharaj, and it sets the direction of the Panth. And for those first Panj Pyare and what they signified, that was the blueprint for a Guru Ka Khalsa. And that's what everybody then aspires to. And that was the journey, as Malcolm Wilson said. He made it accessible. It's not like it's impossible. The roadmap's there, the path is there. And I think that's the beauty of Vasaki and the Khalsa. And I think that's really, you've got to really look into the origins of it, because everything is really simple as well. It's not overly complicated. These things are actually very simple messages, and they're so time relevant that they're not just all only relevant to 1699 or 1700. They're absolutely relevant today. So I think the more we look into this, and the more an individual sort of explores their own Sikhi and their own journey, but do it from the actual origins of it, I think it really will resonate, and it empowers people more.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just touching on one of those points, Chaz, I think it's beyond argument that inequality still exists in India today. I think that's not even an argument. So I think the need for the Khalsa today is stronger, and as strong as it's ever been. Sukhbir, I think it's a good time to kind of bring you in. And again, thanks for taking the time to join us. I wanted to kind of start with something and it was quite significant, really. I think Vaisakhi is quite commonly titled as the birth and the creation of the Khalsa, when I think we've all kind of agreed that sort of the manifestation of the Khalsa is a more accurate term. Do you want to, I suppose, start with commenting on that sort of difference and kind of letting the viewers know, I suppose, giving the viewers sort of insight into that?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you very much for having me today. Very pleased to be here. What Jazz has said, what McConnell has said, it is absolutely 100% correct. In a sense, the Khalsa, the creation of the Khalsa is the culmination of a project, if you want to think of it that way. I mean, other faiths have one, in most cases, prophets, if you will, or kind of religious leaders, or, you know, whatever word you want, Pagamber, if you want to call them that. And the Sikhs have 10. In fact, you know, in some ways, the evolution was so difficult from where they were to where they ended up 220 odd years later. I don't think it would have been able to achieve that in a single lifetime. So in a sense, it was going to take a long time. It was a gentle progression, but again, it was always the same. People sometimes misunderstand Sikhi, and they think that, oh, you know, there's different gurus, so various different gurus were different. And I find this more so with actually non-Sikhs than actual Sikhs, who'll be, oh, well, Guru Nanak, he didn't wear a gurban, and he wasn't this way, and he wasn't. Well, actually, well, not into, I mean, it, what you have to understand is that the message was exactly the same. What's incredible about Sikhi, and you can see this because obviously we have a living guru, which is testament to all of the words and everything, and other people, in fact, other thoughts and beliefs which were included in the Guru Granth Sahib from people who were not the Sikh gurus themselves, are consistent entirely. There's no contradiction at any point within the Guru Granth Sahib that you'll find, and the reason for that is that Guru Nanak's beginning, his where he started out, where he began, was a rejection of what he saw around him. When he saw that the people within India were actually suffering, he didn't understand why religious leaders weren't able to provide any kind of sustenance to them, any kind of guidance. The idea of, okay, you know, we'll do a puja and this is going to help. And, you know, this is Babar Bani at that point where he sees Babar, this tyrant who's entered India, and he's killing and he's raping and he's pillaging. And there's nothing to prevent him from doing that. Guru Nanak literally at that point turns to Akal Purakh and says, don't you see this? Don't you feel something? What's happening to your people here? And it's not a criticism of God, because that never happens within Sikhi. Akal Purakh, we have to live within his hukam at all times. But equally, he could see that the people, whether they were the mullahs or they were the pundits, had no answers to these questions. And Guru Nanak understood in his mind that we're going to have to take these people from where they are to where they're going to be two centuries down the line, and it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen within my lifetime. So he said, where he began, what Jazz said, you know, Jeevan ki shadas, jeevan ki aas tu chhad de. Forget about life, because if you're going to walk this path, you have to understand, my friend, that it's going to take everything. It literally will, at some point in your life, it will mean that you have to say, right, that's it. And don't hesitate. Give it there and then, because ultimately it's not yours anyway. You know, you were given this life. So what we get with the Khalsa, Khalsa is the ultimate culmination of that whole project from Guru Nanak right up through the 9 to the 10th Guru. And then the 10th Guru, this is where the evolution, where it's rebirth. So the Khalsa is reborn. When Guru Gobind Singh Ji is asking for cease, when he's asking for your life, he's asking to transform your life. And the practical application of that, or let's say the evidence of what that revolution, evolution, complete change in mindset was, is very simple. These same people, because the Sikhs are not genetically different, they're not ethnically different. You know, they come from the same genetic stock as most people from that area of the northern subcontinent. But what changed within them? So 700 years of subjugation, 700 years of slavery, suddenly within 2 centuries, within a short period after the Khalsas formed, within a very short period, were sovereign. The Sikhs are sovereign. They've run those people out of the country, the Afghans, the Mughals. They've demolished them all. So what actually changed? What changed? What changed was their mindset changed. Suddenly, that stratification of humanity, which was, okay, somebody's a Brahmin, he's the teacher, somebody's a Khatri, he's the warrior, somebody's a Shudra, he's the one that, you know, does all the dirty work. You know, the Guru said this is all rubbish. In fact, this is the difference. This is the fundamental difference between Sikhi and Hinduism. Hinduism begins with the idea that all people are not created equal. Sikhi begins with the idea that all people, all beings, all people are created equal. And that is a diametric opposite position from the two sides. And that's why I find it quite unusual when people don't understand. You say, well, you know, it's an offshoot of Hinduism. Well, actually, no. Sikhi begins with the rejection of Hinduism. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with Hinduism. Please don't get me wrong. Sikhi, if anything, is the most open, most accepting, most tolerant of the faiths, which is why we remain the bridge between the various faiths, which is where we began. So Guru Gobind Singh Ji, we know there was a point at which somebody, it was a Bir Makhanshah, I think, came and said, you know, who are you with? Are you with the Hindus or are you with the Muslims? And Guru Gobind Singh Ji, as a child, put his hand on both of those bowls to say, look, I'm equal. I don't see the distinction. We are all ekanur the apa hege. You know, and that's the point, that we are all from God. And religion ultimately, and this is what Sikhi understands itself, because it doesn't claim to have divine sort of provenance. It doesn't say that, oh, you know, Guru Nanak doesn't say, well, God spoke to me and he said, start this faith. In the same way that, let's say, Jesus Christ or perhaps Muhammad or perhaps other religions have this kind of this divine revelation story, Sikhi doesn't have that. So with Guru Nanak, he's basically saying that, you know, religion is man-made. It is. But then let's make one then, which brings people together rather than divide them. And so, you know, Sikhi is a unique religion. And in many ways, it's uniqueness, which in some ways brings problems as well for Sikhs within the world in which we live. Because again, we have a foot in both. Sikhs are not entirely based on having a spiritual religion, which means that you go and sit on a, you know, go and sit somewhere on a mountain and do basya for, you know, for decades. And then this is how you, you know, kind of cleanse your soul. Within Sikhi, it's very pragmatic. It's what's the point of doing that? If you're going to bring some goodness into the world, practically get in there. Now, the difficulty with that is if you are a tolerant, open faith, which accepts everybody and everything, then the issue is you also do become vulnerable to this kind of, you know, manipulation by other people or attempted manipulation.
Yeah. But that's the key thing, right? I mean, that's the critical thing, isn't it, Sukhbir? I guess it's that duty that came with it. It wasn't, when the Khalsa was created, it was created on values and principles of Sikhi. And like you said, it was based on love, pyar. But ultimately, you can only sort of be fruitful and fulfill that love if it's reciprocated. And we're living and talking about times where there was great objection to anybody wearing a kirpan other than the Mughal rulers, anybody displaying majesty or their own identity. And Sikhs were targeted for that. And the purpose of the Khalsa was to stand up to that tyranny and that oppression, not only for themselves, but on any faith, as demonstrated by Guru Tegh Bahadur Maharaj. So that was the duty of a Sikh. It was a real clear command. The saint soldier aspect was formed on that basis. And this is, as you touched on, the challenge that's come on sort of since is that whilst we respect all world religions and their own paths and all spiritual scripture, we're also very clear on the Sikh's journey and what is the human life for, but it's also very clear on its duty to stand up against inequality, stand up against discrimination, stand up against oppression and tyranny. And that will be, most cases, tyranny and oppression is done by the majority, the rulers, the state. It was in the Mughals' time. It was in the British time. And it is now with the far-right BJP government. And now what you see is that confidence to stand up against tyranny and stand up against oppression and speak the truth, because don't forget, Sikhi is fundamentally all about the truth, that is being eroded from the identity and from what Khalsa actually stands for or is thought to have stand for today, because it's uncomfortable for a lot of people. They don't want to put their head up and say, you know what, that was wrong. They're more happy and willing to sort of go with the flow and just be good Sikhs and good citizens, and is thinking that this has crept in, that's what a Sikh is to blend in, be there when people need our help for the soft stuff, whether it's langar and shelter. But actually, why do they need these things? It's because the state or something has broken and it needs somebody to call that out. And yet the irony is they're not willing to either step into that realm, or even worse now, they'll stop others stepping into that and doing that role. And that's a real problematic situation for us.
I think it goes back to what Sukhbir was saying about manipulation. So I think we've all seen in the last week the attempted manipulation of the meaning of Baisakhi, is effectively people who are trying to manipulate Sikhi. So even, the UK government puts out a happy Baisakhi message with a drum on it. That's just, for me,
laziness, right? It's laziness.
Yeah, it's a massive signal of manipulation. Yeah, ignorance. And Mankuma, what have you made of
it? Yeah, that's it, yeah. Yeah, sorry, I think you're going to ask the question. That was probably going to go for it.
Go for it.
I'd take it a bit further. I mean, there is something going on, and there's always been something going on in terms of trying to suppress, the whole entire sort of Sikh thought, into the mainstream. And it's always been then, we use the word stand up to, it's more than that. We're built on resistance. Our history has been built on organizing and organizing resistance against tyranny. And, we're so far away from that kind of thought at the moment that even standing up to, even making a statement, even talking up is something we're unable to do. But that, that heritage that we come from, way further than that. I mean, I'm just going to use a small example. Jasmine, Sukhbir, we've been around long enough to have seen this whole demonization of Sikh activists, this whole cyclical thing. About 20 years ago, people like me, Jaz and Sukhbir, probably couldn't speak as openly as we can speak now, even on our own platforms, because there was so much resistance against Sikh activism. We just post 84, our own community, and the 90s, our own community were trying to dumb us down and everything. And then all of a sudden, it was this whole shift about people hiding their Sikhi. And then I think something happened in the 2010s where it became cool to be Sikh again, and all of a sudden, giving out langar, all these kind of things, getting praise from David Cameron, pats on the back and all of that. All of a sudden people started saying, I think it's pretty cool to be a Sikh. And I feel we then created, or we've not created, we saw this generation come out, utilize and take advantage of that as a platform to build their own profiles. And that's what we're suffering from with the gatekeepers that we have today that have taken out. They've used the platform to advantage. I'll tell you something. 15, 20 years ago, they would have not come out. They would have been too scared to say that they're Sikh. And just because the circumstances changed, just because the profile changed or the attitude mainstream attitude changed for that short period. Things are different, but now we're going through it again. Now we've got that demonization. We've got, you know, not just from the Indian government, but we've got it seeping through from commentators on the West, and social media just perpetuates that as well. So, you know, we're really fighting a big info battle at this point in time. I mean, Sukhbir, you can probably comment on this, but I would say it's one of the biggest that we've had probably since 84.
Yeah, I mean, '84 was, it was an entirely different landscape. I mean, obviously, it was pre-social media. Social media's changed everything. I mean, social media is a double-edged sword. You know, I mean, there's no way around that. Some people thought in the early stages of the social media or certainly the internet that it was kind of democratization of opinion and various other things. And in fact, it's not that. I think if you look at it as a net in terms of people who are marginalized or who are, you know, struggling to get their voices into the mainstream, I think overall it's a net negative rather than a net positive. And the thing about the internet is that it's a move away from a print-based culture. And the thing about print-based culture is it has accountability. It doesn't have the anonymous nature of the internet where people can say something one day, it's taken off, it's manipulated afterwards. You don't know who's saying what or where it begins. I mean, I remember really in the very early days of the internet, I remember getting onto the internet probably around about 1998, something like that, very early on. And the first thing that I was looking for, because again, the access to information, again, 84, but through the 80s, the Indian state controlled the whole information landscape entirely. There was no other, apart from really kind of very small circulation newspapers here and there, there was no presence of Sikh opinion. So it was very much for them to rule the roost, to define the narrative. And in fact, that is the crux of why we are where we are now. I mean, if you think about it, if you think about, say, you think about Guru Gobind Singh Jimchum Kaur, you know, that battle happens, the whole Panth, the whole community understands that narrative. There's one narrative and it's the right narrative. And what happens in 84 is that the government, the Indian government, controls the narrative. I mean, I remember going to Punjab in the early 90s, 1992, something like that, and speaking to a bunch of, you know, young Sikhs. And I mentioned them, this was Ropar. Now, Ropar is in Jalandhar district, and it was the site of one of the really kind of, I suppose, you know, most used interrogation centres, as they're called euphemistically. I mean, they are essentially torture and murder centres. And hundreds, if not maybe thousands, nobody knows, people went into that, young people, who would have been tortured mercilessly and then disappeared. And again, another euphemism for murdered and killed. Now, these lads grew up. Some of them would have been quite young at the point, but they would have been under 10 years old, or perhaps, or even their older brothers. They didn't know anything about it. They lived within, I'd say, probably less than a mile or a mile and a half from this place. And they knew nothing about it. And I found that shocking. Me, who's, you know, living thousands of miles away in the UK, was aware of this place. And these people who grew up around it knew nothing about it. And the reason for that is that India managed to control, the Indian state managed to control the information flow to such a great extent that people did not know what was happening. Forget between districts, say Malwa, Madhya Dwaba, you wouldn't know. Between villages, you wouldn't know what was going on. So you may be seeing something. Now, this is what happens. That narrative then, which was the correct narrative, because let's be honest again, and this is an important point to make. People say, well, there's two sides to a story and I've got an opinion, you've got an opinion. Well, there are opinions, but that doesn't take away from objective truth. Objective truth is singular. It isn't my truth or your truth. It's what happened. So as an example, Operation Blue Star happened. There's no doubt about that. We all know it happened. Thousands of people were massacred there. We all know that too. Now, the difference comes in the narrative of why that happened and what led up to that happening. Now, again, we know between us why it happened. We know what led up to it. But the majority of Indians certainly have no idea. And that problem, if you will, of understanding also exists within the Sikh community. That's why we're divided over this. So if you think about Chamkor and think about 84 and Blue Star, that is the issue. Before, the Mughals didn't do what they did and then spend, you know, lots of resources on trying to convince the Sikhs that they never did it. They didn't care. They did it and said, we did it. That's how it is. What the Indian state did is they'd already pre-prepared the propaganda before they'd even launched the assault, because they knew that they had to control the information so that the Sikhs would not build a narrative. They wouldn't happen. If you think about it, if you think about 1947, that changed the Sikh Arvas. The Sikh Arvas changed as a result of partition. And really and truly, it should have changed after 84, but it didn't. And it didn't for a reason, because you have, again, this split in the community, which is driven by the state, but is also helped enormously by vested interests within the Sikhs themselves. So you have this kind of people who have a vested interest in the status quo, who do not want that narrative to become all pervasive throughout the Sikh community. If that narrative had become, if the truth of 84 was known by the vast majority of Sikhs, we wouldn't be having this conversation here.
No, and I think that's where it comes down to. It's all around laying the groundwork for demonization. Now, if you have, and if you look at the history of the Sikh Qaum, and you talked about the sacrifice of our gurus, and it's the irony is you have Modi, the Indian Prime Minister, and BJP's sort of over celebrating the contribution and the sacrifices of our gurus, and at the same time completely disrespecting the values in which they gave those sacrifices. This is played out all over the place by non-Sikhs in this country, by Sikhs in this country, is that they recognize the sacrifice of Guru Arjan Dev Ji, Guru Tegh Bahadur Ji, the Char Sahib Jadde, Mata Gujar Kaur Ji, but they completely ignore the reasons why. The Char Sahib Jadde stood in front of the ruler of the state, the Chhote Sahib Jadde, and said, we don't succumb to your demands. We won't bow our heads to you. We won't adopt your faith, no matter what you bribe us with, or you lure us with, or whether you threaten us with. They stood up against that. And at the same time, we want to celebrate them, but we will actually sort of pull and demonize our own Sikhs that even sort of nowhere on that level, but even attempt to walk that path and challenge the oppressors. And that whole demonization, what it did for the Indian government was it allowed them to massacre a community. Because if you can go en masse through their radio and TV and say, these people are the enemy, you identify them by their identity. And this was quite clever when Indira Gandhi, on the 14th of June, and wrote, put pen to paper on this comment, whilst it was said over the radios, we have it in black and white. In her letter on the 14th of June to Margaret Thatcher, she wrote, it is those in the religious garb, the star, the dara, and the gatra, that are the most dangerous and the threat to the unity of India. I.e., any Amritdhari Gursikh is a threat and is a terrorist. That's where they coined that demonization, and that translated straight to the United Kingdom. And that was then put into the UK policy, because we had this in the revelations. That is in clear cabinet meeting discussions, letters between Margaret Thatcher and Indira Gandhi at the time clearly state. And that demonization went across India, that these Sikhs are the root of evil. They want to destroy India. Again, the whole narrative of Pakistan influence and infiltration, the big old enemy Pakistan, always involved in everything, to really make Sikhs hated. And that's why they were celebrated for attacking the Sikhs and Sri Darbar Sahib. I mean, never could that even be contemplated, but it was actually rewarded. Indira Gandhi won a landslide election off the back of it. And then you have another genocide in Delhi, and Rajiv Gandhi is sworn in again with another landslide. All that, basically ethnic cleansing of a minority faith, which was all underpinned by this whole demonization of those Panj Kakar that Guru Gobind Singh Ji adorned and gifted the Qaum. And we see that today. And these issues, when the state and the country in which you live demonizes you and labels you terrorists and identifies your markers as triggers of terrorism, hard to identify, characteristics of terrorism, you're then going to suffer and struggle. And we've seen Sikhs in the diaspora, whilst again, you've got global corporations now celebrating Vaisakhi, governments across the world celebrating Vaisakhi. But how many of them have restrictions and limitations and discriminations against the Kakar themselves?
I was just going to say, I mean, that just one thing that came to mind when she was saying that, and you mentioned Pakistan. So there was an insult, a kind of a rhyme, if you will, Gesh Kara Karpan, Enugejo Pakistan. And again, it comes down to the same thing. It's not really, if you think about it, it's not the Sikhs per se, Sikhs, you know, in inverted commas, that's the problem. It's Sikhi's the problem.
Because
Sikhi is actually the problem. If you have non-observant Sikhs who call themselves Sikhs, then that's not an issue. The problem with Sikhi is Sikhi does not will not compromise on truth, right? At the end of the day, this is the problem that governments have. That's why it's always been called the Sikh problem. It was the Sikh problem for the British. It's the Sikh problems now for the Indians. And the Sikh problem is basically that. So the fact that you would single out Amrit Dhari Sikhs, which essentially, when we attach Amrit Dhari to the word Sikh, it's a bit of a misnomer, because a Sikh is by definition Amrit Dhari. A Sikh is, at the end of the day, we're all of us, even those that aren't, we at least accept that we're on a path, and that is the ideal. Now, if you call yourself a Sikh and you say, well, actually Khalsa Rehth and becoming a Khalsa and joining the, that's not my ideal. Well, then you're in the wrong path. You're not a Sikh, because at the very least, that's what should be your ultimate ambition if your faith matters. Now, you've got to remember, just as in all other faiths, you have observant people, you have non-observant people, you have some people who don't give a monkeys about the faith that you're born into. Now, if you do believe in Sikhi, or any religion for that matter, you do believe that there is a divine creator, that something larger than anything else that we know of or that we have any capacity to be exists, that has created all things and created you and put you into a house of a Sikh house, as an example, at a period in history where that community is undergoing persecution. Now, you have a special responsibility for that reason, that this is, if you want to know what's my path in life, you probably do a lot of things, but that's certainly got to be part of it. And for those that live in the diaspora, especially, we're an even smaller minority. I mean, the Sikhs are a tiny minority to start with, if you think about the world as a whole. Then you look at the subcontinent, again, very, very small minority. And then you think of the Sikhs that live in the diaspora, again, a very, very tiny percentage of the overall population of the world. Now, where you happen to live as part of the diaspora, you have a special responsibility to be able to raise your voice, because that's what is missing in Punjab at the moment. So as an example, and moving it sort of into the present time to some degree, is we have a young man who is an Indian citizen, thought, well, you know what? I'm going to go back to India. I'm going to go back to Punjab, and I'm going to work within the state's own stated legal framework. I'm not going to step outside of that and do everything which is completely legal, which is completely, you know, as far as the Indian state is concerned, as far as the constitution is concerned, as far as the Indian Supreme Court is concerned, is completely legitimate and isn't illegal in any way whatsoever. Because I remember, and Montgomery knows this, for years and years and years, one of the comebacks always from especially those people living in India, anti-self-determination people, if you want to call it that, is, oh, well, you know, it's you lot outside. It's you lot in Canada and the UK and the US who want some kind of discussion about self-determination. The people in Punjab, they don't care. Well, actually, they do care. And if they're not raising their voice, well, you know why? Because you can see what happens when you raise your voice. And, you know, Bhai Amrit Pal Singh is not the first. You had the Namasher Singhs who, you know, handed out leaflets. Again, a completely, you know, peaceable, non-legal thing to do, a completely legal thing to do within the Indian framework, within the Indian legal system. What happens to them? What happens to anybody? So this is the issue. If you can't raise your voice within that Indian state, it's obviously going to happen that people outside, again, we look at the Gaddar movement that came from outside of India. And why did it come from outside? Well, because the British state would crush anybody saying those things or thinking about those things within the state. So there's nothing unusual, but I would say that certainly Sikhs that live in the diaspora have a responsibility. The other thing that I would say just quickly as well is that it's not all doom and gloom, in the sense that we've been here before. The Sikhs have been here in much more worse situations, much more difficult situations, far, far greater enemies, far more powerful enemies. I mean, the people that we're, you know, that we're in a sense up against at the moment are the same people that lived those centuries under subjugation, and we overturned, we beat their oppressors. So the point is that all that Sikhs have to do is just understand where they are, understand their own history. That understanding, that appreciation, once it comes, and it will come, that will change things. The concept of Jardi Gala is such a powerful, powerful thing that we have to maintain. And I know it's difficult in times like this. When I think about Jaggi as an example, so Jaggi is another good example. Why was Jaggi taken? Jaggi was taken to shut up the people in the diaspora that are raising their voice, in the same way Amritpal Singh was taken, or his Sathis have been taken, for the same reason. It's symbolic. It's to send a message: shut up, close your mouth and don't speak. Now, what I will say about Jaggi, just as an example, I've spoken to quite a few young people. My son's, you know, he's in his late teens. A number of them who had no interest at all within this situation, within what happened in 84 and everything else, as a result of Jaggi being taken, have started taking a real interest, started reading, started writing. And this is it. This is what they don't understand and what they should understand, because this is a lesson from history. Every Jaggi you take, there'll be 50 more. Every Amritpal Singh you take, there'll be 100 more, and so on and so forth. You cannot crush the Sikhs in the way that you can. Governments before you've tried, far more capable, powerful governments before you've tried, and they've all failed.
It's like they don't see the obvious. It's like history's in front of them. And Sanjana Singh Pindrawale said this many times. He says, many rulers and many authorities have tried to crush the Sikhs. All have failed and all have disappeared. And this will happen for the present one. And that was the Congress. And you can see what happened to the Congress. And now it's the BJP's turn. And again, these things are cyclic. And I think the most powerful thing you said there, Sukhbir, is that actually we don't need to worry about our enemies or our oppressors, right? Because that's in our DNA to fight. We just need to look at ourselves.
Absolutely. 100%.
If we just all, and that one word you said, and Kamal and I have seen this over years within establishments and organizations that we set up, like the Sikh Council UK, is that word compromise. And you can see it from both examples. When the Panth stands together and we don't compromise on principles, and that's not being sort of militant or aggressive or extreme, it's just that these are our religious values and these are highly respected by every other faith. And they're well known. It's not this, we always get into this, oh, they don't understand or there's an education. No, they do know. But we're too quick to compromise. And the two examples I give you, because obviously we're talking about the Kakar, Vaisakhi Nakar, the Kirpan. We have had instances in the UK where the Kirpan has had multiple limitations, restrictions placed on it. And we've had to fight them in the courts, with government. And then there were Sikhs who would then propose, oh, it's okay to wear a wooden kirpan, or it's okay to weld it so it's not a danger to somebody else.
A replica, or wear a replica kirpan or something. Yeah.
We even had modern Sikhs who were giving the necklace kirpana to theme parks like Drayton Manor to say, you know what, when an Amritdhari Sikh comes in with a kirpan, get them to deposit it in a safe, in a box, and give them this, right? And these are Sikhs who are doing this. And when we don't compromise, like when the offensive weapons bill was coming through legislation in 2018, it started, 2019. The Sikh, mainly it was the Sikh Federation, the APPG, we fought it and told everybody what was involved. And this was about to ban the large kirpan. It would have been illegal to have a 3-foot kirpan in your house, in a gurdwara, anywhere in public.
Yeah. And think about that. You're talking about grooms as well who carry the kirpan.
Weddings, exactly. Nagar Kirtans. We're on about Nagar Kirtans are happening this weekend. The Panj Pyare walk with an unsheathed Baddi kirpan. That would have been outlawed. Yeah, we fought that and we overturned the law and protections were written in. So you don't have to compromise. We shouldn't even be thinking about compromising. Because the minute we do, we are doing a huge disservice to not only the shaheeds of our Qaum, but to our gurus and what the whole philosophy was of the Amrit Sanchar and Vaisakhi. But then again, we want to all sort of claim the fluffy side of it. And that's something which, I mean, it's a question to you, Montgomery, I guess. Have we just allowed others to define what a Gur Sikh is and what the values of Sikh is and gone away from what our guru told us?
Yeah, but I mean, I think you framed it well there, because this is it. This is it. It's others define us now. We don't define ourselves. You know, we let non-Sikhs define the Sikh. And that's the challenge that we have. You know, I've been involved now. I think I've done a whole journey of conforming, of trying to conform, where you dumb down things and you try and sort of to get something past. You think, we won't mention this side, but we'll mention the good side. We'll mention the fluffy side. So, you know, I put a tweet out recently. I just used a joke. I said, you know, we were chiefs, now we're chefs. You know, chiefs in the sense that, you know, the whole origin of the word Sardar comes from chief, you know, because we were landowners and we're just known for being chefs. You know, we provide langar. You know, we're those people that the other religions turn to say, oh, we've got the Sikhs, bring them on board. You know, they'll bring the samosas or whatever on our event.
Yeah.
You know, we have become that, and that's how we're being defined. You know, and as it makes it easier, it makes it more palatable for them to say, oh, the Sikhs, they're the nice guys that cook food. They're the guys that, you know. I mean, what frustrates me is how this whole stereotype, don't get me wrong, I mean, I understand the martial side, I get all of that, but this stereotype that we are meant to be profession, you know, have a profession or a role, a special role within the armed forces of another nation or within the police force of another nation, it's a job, but don't attach it to anything more than that and say, no, it's something more than that, because, you know, you come from that kind of background, you come from a martial background and your gurus would have wanted you to be police people, policemen or police women or army staff or whatever. You know, that's not the case. That's just...
And look at it. I mean, look, this week, right, we saw, and so Kabir mentioned the impact and the awareness of Amrit Pal Singh in terms of reigniting that consciousness of your sovereignty. Because fundamentally, that's all it was. All he's done is gone back to Punjab, told people about the struggle and the problems within Punjab, whether it's the drug, alcohol, rivers, water issues. And he's told them about where they come from, reminded them of where they come from, that actually we are a sovereign, pure Khalsa. And that's what we are. And when you recognize that, you will just stand up naturally. And it's not violent, but it's standing up for your rights. And what the state has done is turned that civil rights movement or awakening into a criminal offense. And what's even worse is global democracies are following suit, and they're falling for that trap. And you've got the United Kingdom, who MPs stood up in the House of Commons, Bob Blackman, and said that UK is harboring terrorists, that those who are calling out human rights abuses, shutting down the internet, draconian measures by the police and the state to oppress a minority, as those who raise their voice against that are terrorists. And a week, and that's fine. And then a week later, he sends out a message.
A Vaisakhi message.
that we all, collective faith, all born as a collective faith, happy Vaisakhi. And I mean, what, did you forget that actually what Vaisakhi is about? And this is what we're saying, is people are picking and choosing what they think our faith represents and massively distorting it. And I think we all have a duty. Certainly everyone listening to the podcast here is, we have a duty to defend what our faith is. I think we said it earlier, we all know the journey. We all know the path. We can't change that. And anyone who's trying to adjust it to suit their agenda, we should be calling them out. It's not everyone can work the path, right? And everybody absolutely aspires to, and we're all on a journey, and it doesn't discriminate against anybody. Certainly,
Look at the diversity of this podcast. I mean, I know people can't see our faces, but Sukhraj and Sukhbir, I mean, you know, people look at you. You've not got, you're not the star.
This is what I was going to say in terms of, we've mentioned we're letting people outside Sikhi try and define it. I think the bigger problem is internally. As you've mentioned, I'm a Sajdari Sikh. I don't have a turban, but
I'm not here to adjust Sikhi to follow my shortcomings. I'm very aware of the path, and I'm definitely not looking to change that path just so I can feel at ease as where I'm at. It's obviously not, you know, spiritually and externally as well. And I see that far too much within Sikhs of, you know, like you've just mentioned, we're happy with the fluffy side. You know, I'm very comfortable with where, you know, where the Rasta is, and I'm definitely not changing the path. And we accept our own shortcomings, and, you know, we just day to day, we look to work on those. So, and I think that's, you know, within, I mentioned that, you know, I'll go back to that, you know, the drum thing about Happy Vaisakhi. You know, I've had, you know, I think in WhatsApp today, I've had it over the last few days from different people I know and family members, and it really makes me sick to the stomach, to be fair. And, you know, I think the big push is, like you said, going out into the community and actually making people understand this. And, you know, we're on this podcast, me and Sabir are on this podcast, we're Monday. We're having this discussion. It's not a case of one or nothing or everything. We accept our path. We accept where we are, but, you know, we're not here to mess around with what the guru said and, you know, how and how it was manifested. So, yeah, just touching on that point, Jazz.
We talked about compromise, right? And you're going to see on Monday the 17th, Downing Street will be hosting a Vaisakhi event. And probably over the last, probably say 10 years now, you've seen an absolute dilution of who gets invited to these events. And that's the impression or the understanding of Sikhi that policymakers and decision makers have. And it suits their purpose. There'll be people there who are completely compromised from a Sikhi perspective. There'll be people there who are not of the faith, but claim to represent the faith. And this is what we have here, certainly in the United Kingdom.
It's
now
a terrible event, though, Jazz. I mean, we've been through it. I hated it.
But what it does is, I mean, putting the event aside, what it does is it's again the state selecting who they deem as a Sikh, who they deem as a Sikh representative, and how they want to mark Sikh events, right? It's like the establishment telling us how Sikhi should be. That's the deeper message of it. I mean, and I think that's where, no one really pays that much attention to it. I think those that go, certainly the ones that claim to be representatives, those are the ones that are kind of outcast and don't have any grassroots recognition or respect. But the situation, which is why ministers, why government will use dangerous language like militants, extremists, separatists, about those who actually talk about the tenets of the faith. And those that are completely disconnected from the roots of the Sikhi and the faith are then deemed to be considered moderate thinking Sikhs and more purists. And that's a real, I think, challenge for us in this country of how do we work through that?
I mean, self-determination is no crime.
It isn't, but it's being made into one for
Sikhs. It's you know, and being a separatist as well. I mean, I think we're using it as a negative word now, but it's not. I mean, you know, again, you've got the SNP party here. You mentioned it in the last podcast. You know, they're the third party of parliament. You know, this country's, you know, recognizes that and understands that. So, you know, why that turnaround and why we're allowed to be demonized for having, you know, exerting our right for a Khalistan or for a Sikh Raj. That, to be honest with you, you know, if you go back in our history, going back to 1849, all the treaties that were signed and stuff, it's a right that we still have, and it's a right that we can exercise. I know, Sukhbir, you've spoken extensively on self-determination, and, you know, how it's sort of, even the Supreme Court in India recognizes the right for self-determination. So again, that being used as a beating stick to keep on arresting Sikhs is just, you know, it's just plain tyranny.
It did not. I mean, so, you know, the UK is a good example. So you have the SNP, we even have Sinn Féin, you know, who refused to take their seats in Parliament because of the history. However, they are British MPs. And of course, you know, we know the history of Northern Ireland, but the British know the history of Northern Ireland too. which is why you have the SNP, why you've had Plaid Cymru, because they understand that you cannot crush an independence movement with the use of force. That's why they don't. If the SNP, if you think about where the SNP was, you think about the SNP 20 years ago, the SNP was a joke. I mean, it was, and what I mean, I don't mean that in an insulting way. It was a political joke. You know, this is the day, this is like pre-Alex Salmond. It wasn't even considered to be something that was ever going to, I mean, the idea of the SNP ever coming into power in Scotland was a pipe dream. And yet, you know, it happened. So they understood that if they had gone in there, if the British had sent, you know, armed forces into Scotland, as an example, to suppress, you know, a good proportion of that country. And in fact, in those days, a very small proportion, really, of the Scottish population were interested in independence. What would have happened is you would have had a majority of Scots starting to think about independence, because, you know, all of this comes from no group of people anywhere. And you can look at independence movements throughout the world, wherever they've sprouted, they've always come from the tyranny of the state. I mean, the Sikhs didn't want Khalistan. Let's be honest, the Sikhs did not want Khalistan. That is not what Operation Blue Star was about. It's Operation Blue Star, the subsequent pogroms of 84, and then the decade of a Sikh cull, essentially, throughout Punjab through Woodrow's, which made Khalistan an issue for Sikhs. The Sikhs look at Khalistan, and the idea of Khalistan, the idea of sovereignty for us, really, is a forced issue. Because if we'd wanted that, if that had been our desire, if we were hungry, if you want to put it that way, if we were hungry for Raj, the British offered us Raj. The British offered in the 1920s round table talks, they were talking to the Sikhs then and said, look, take your state. We'll even do the administration for 10 years just to get you up to speed so you understand how it all works. Of course, for their own benefit, they weren't trying to help us out. Just any empire is only in its business for itself. And anything that happens, which happens to vicariously advantage the native population, isn't meant to happen. I mean, it happens fine, but it's not their first purpose. And that's not what they were trying to do. But the Sikhs at that point, even in the 40s, when this conversation was becoming more mature, when it was obvious that independence home rule was coming, it was the Congress, it was Nehru and Gandhi who were appealing to the Sikhs, saying, look, you are our protectors. You are the people that feed us. You are our farmers. We won't be able to live without you guys. That was the thing. The pressure was put upon the Sikhs to say, don't be selfish. Now, understanding Sikhi and Sikh psyche, the Sikhs obviously felt duty bound to go along with it. And if you think about it, they weren't wrong. The Sikhs weren't wrong to go along with the idea of joining India. Subsequently, we've come to this point, and it's clear that, you know, there was no good faith. Everything was said in bad faith. But from a Sikh perspective, if you think about Sikh identity, Sikh theology, Sikh thought, it was the right thing to do, not to be selfish, to take your own sovereignty, but to do what's for the betterment of the larger group, right? So for, you know, like if we go with, the idea of Sarbat Papala, that's the idea. And so they were right to do it. Now, when we get into the present day, we can look back at them and we can say, well, you know, perhaps we were naive, and I think absolutely politically naive. But again, it's not us that are at fault. If you were betrayed by somebody else, it's not your fault. It's the person that's betrayed you. It's their fault. They're at fault. You've just done what was the right thing. So that's, you know, that's kind of, and when you talk about conformity and you know, about the British state, what we have to remember here is that the UK government, whether in the 80s or now, is not going to support a small minority like us who can't really offer them anything in terms of kind of material advantage, in the short term at least, in comparison to pallying up to the nation state and, you know, getting all the advantages, the free trade deals and everything else that goes along with that. That's just geopolitics, the way it works. But here's how fickle it is, and here's why we shouldn't put so much emphasis on commentators on Western media or even the broader kind of establishment, because the establishments are intertwined with each other. They have vested interest. An American president once said, nations don't have friends, they have interests. And that's kind of where we are. So you can even envisage a situation not very far down the line if the Modi government continues on its stance that it has with regards to Ukraine, and it actually advantages or favors cheap oil over the idea of standing by its allies in condemning Russia, it's not a very big step from that, should India continue down that path, where suddenly you'll start seeing, and we have seen it just a few days after the abstention at the UN, we had Jake Sullivan, I believe it was, start talking about human rights in India, which they don't generally care about, they don't generally talk about. But you can envisage a situation where they start to get unhappy with India, suddenly the Kashmiris cause will be, you know, worth talking about. The Sikh cause will be worth talking about. And that's how fickle geopolitics is. So yeah. We shouldn't play that game. It's not our game to play. You know, Guru Nanak in Guru Nanak Dev Ji in Japaji Sahib says, Manne Taram Nachale Panth, Manne Taram Seti Sanbam. In the sense of, if you are connected to truth, don't go with the crowd. Don't conform. Your relationship should be at all times with the truth, first and foremost. The world can be going in this direction or that direction. If you stay true to who you are and to truth, you'll never go wrong. Fashions change, fickle as they are.
And we've seen that with the Raj, Sikh Raj come and go, right? And we saw that with the extreme sacrifice of the Chhote Sahib Jadde. And within a decade, within a few years, you saw the Raj of Banda Singh Bahadur across Punjab. And this is, these events have been synonymous with Vaisakhi as well. And we're going to come and talk about the history, but since, I think, 1801, Maharaja Ranjit Singh was crowned the emperor of the Sikh kingdom on Vaisakhi. And then we had the traumatic events of 1919 Vaisakhi, where the British government opened fire on thousands and killing thousands of Sikh innocent citizens at Jallianwala Bagh. And we saw how that event was recorded in British history. And we are still yet waiting for an apology from the government of this country for that massacre. And then you've got the Amritsar massacre in 1978, which then led to the Tarmiyud Morcha, which went on in 1984 and really woke the consciousness of Sikhs up, when you had fake God men being propagated by the state again to distort the truth, distort Gurbani, and take Sikhs, those that are having this awakening, to completely the psychological genocide that we're seeing again replayed today. And the 13 Sikhs of the Jatha who did a peaceful protest were just gunned down, and their perpetrators were all let free. And then you get the Sarbat Khalsa in 1986, which is on the 29th of April, which is again around the Vaisakhi time. So Vaisakhi is such an important event. It isn't just about going to the Gurdwara and walking across the Nagar Kirtan and taking the langar and the sweets. Actually, it's a huge sort of pivotal moment in our history at various times. And we've talked about it on this podcast around the aspect of the Khalsa, why it was important, what the values of Panch Pyare, the Kakar, what they all mean and what they stand for, and what we fight, why we fight for that identity, because it's in our DNA. But also, it is bringing Sikhi together. And on Vaisakhi and other big events is where key decisions made. And now, in for this Vaisakhi, obviously, Bhai Amrit Pal, who's still out at large, evading the Indian authorities, did call for Sarbat Khalsa at this Vaisakhi at Damdama Sahib. And we saw the state of India enact draconian laws, section 144 again, where you no one can gather on Vaisakhi. I mean, how ludicrous is that? That you, the biggest occasion, you are trying to limit gatherings of anybody more than four. But again, it's just to demonstrate that Sikhs are inferior and second-class citizens. But still, Sangatan have been gathering at Damdama Sahib all this week. The Qaum has a real issue. We have big issues of the Bandi Singhs. Sikhs have been in prison for 25 years, 10 years over their sentences. We have these issues that we're coming to terms with and dealing with. We have the Be'adabi of Sri Guru Granth Sahib Ji Maharaj left unpunished. We have our institutes that need freeing. And we've now got the 12 Singhs who are been shipped out to Assam, which is 2,500 miles away from Punjab, under NSA, National Security Act, which is the most draconian law, again, built on old British laws. We had the Rowley Act which is really reborn in PADA, UAPA, and the NSA, all that is these laws give the power to take your human rights from any citizen without any rhyme or reason. And that's what India is doing with these 12 individuals under this mega crackdown of members of Wireless Punjab, or associates or considered associates. One of them is a UK resident, and they're now languishing in Assam with no justifiable charges, but the act on which they're arrested justifies their arbitrary detention. And this is now happening on this Vaisakhi, and I think these are the sorts of things we talked about. Jiggy still being incarcerated in his arbitrary detention 5 years on. These are issues for the Sikh community today to be talking about. And anyone who's at a Nagar Kirtan this week or next week, these are the sorts of things that Sikhs should be coming together and discussing at the Gurdwara, at the Nagar Kirtan. So rather than having a chat with your friends and your colleagues when you're walking on the Nagar Kirtan about the football or the sport or the langar, talk about these issues. You'll be surprised how much people will be thinking about them or how they have an opinion on them. And if they don't, inform them. So I think it comes on us that the more we talk about it, look, we do it on this podcast for an hour every week. But it's about empowering those listening to then have these conversations, do your research, and that ripple effect will have a huge impact because it's awakening. All this is, it awakens people up. And as what you said, Sukhbir, that this is an idea. Sikhi is a way of life. It's how we live our life. And this is, you can choose to, or you can be awoken to live a certain way and speak up as soon as you have the knowledge, and the knowledge is power. And hopefully anyone listening to this podcast, but another, finally, I guess, is Vadanya, the Allah Kalak of Vadanya, Vaisakhi Diyan to everybody. But please really use Vaisakhi as a point in the year to really think and contemplate on the issues of the Sikh Panth today and what you can do for it. And that would all
absolutely. I mean, episode, and I'd really recommend episode 19 and episode 20. The last two episodes are very powerful in that. I mean, episode 19, we had Shamshir Singh from the Khalistan Center who gave a really powerful overview about context around, you know, what's going on in Punjab, as well as what we had in the last episode as well. And, you know, again, just repeating what Shamshir spoke about, I mean, do listen to that podcast to hear it in more depth, but, you know, he used the example of Assam and the prison in Assam to how the British used to treat the Sikh prisoners at that time who were standing up to British Raj and being taken to the Andaman Islands, Nicobar Islands, you know, taken. I mean, I went on holiday to Penang this summer and didn't realize, you know, the history of Penang in Malaysia, where the first prisoners of war that were taken there into Penang prison when it was built by the British were Sikh from the Anglo-Sikh War from 1849. And, you know, so, you know, they were taken far away from their homelands on purpose so that they are degraded.
They're forgotten about as well. Yeah.
They have no connection, or, you know, and they did get forgotten about as well. So the last prisoner in Penang, Sikh prisoner from the Anglo-Sikh War, died in early 1900s, I believe. And, you know, he was looked after. By that time, the sepoys, Sikh sepoys had come to Malaysia, and he was looked after by them. So you're right. I mean, this person would have been a young person during that war, taken to prison there and just left and forgotten about and just died. So, you know, this is what happens. So while we fight for our detainees and we fight for our political prisoners, there's a reason we fight for it, because, you know, we've seen it happen.
Absolutely. And I think we've really tried hard on this podcast to kind of explain, you know, the kind of crux of the matter and kind of why the Indian government is acting, and history is continuing to repeat itself. And I think even with self-determination and the word Khalistan, it's kind of being kind of associated with kind of, you know, angry Sikhs walking around. And I think more people than should have actually swallowed that narrative. And kind of, I'll probably finish off on, I think it's one of Sidhu Moosewala's last interviews where he was talking about Khalistan, and he was saying, look at Maharaja Ranjit Singh's Raj. That's the reference. If you want to have an understanding of what Khalistan might be about, what, you know, what we're looking for, that is a reference point. And
you know, Maharaj and Ranjit Singh. And we know the BBC isn't looking to do us any favors, but what was it, their World Histories magazine in about 2020, was it? They labeled him as the greatest leader of all time. So why was that? You know, yeah. because he was crazy? No, look into this. And as Jaz said, we urge people, look into this, read into this. And it kind of coincides with the massive fear from India of people like Amritpal Singh coming and just speaking the truth and doing zero illegal, anything wrong. If anything, they're doing, you know, great stuff in terms of, you know, the whole addiction issue and everything else. And the fear of the government to send people thousands of miles away, it's, you know, this should be really clear as to the narrative going around. So, and we can only fight this with education. So let's all sort of take the time to put the effort in to kind of look into why this is going on and kind of what our self-determination is actually all about. So, but guys, you know, this has been, you know, a truly kind of educational hour and a bit. Sukhbir Singh, again, big thank you for you know, taking the time out. You've really dropped some great gems here today, and I'm sure that our listeners will really sort of appreciate that and kind of get some wisdom into that. So, no, guys, it's, again, you know, lak badaiyan to all listeners and everyone here on Baisakhi this year, you know, and as Jaz said, get out to your Nagar Kirtans, you know, and really kind of, and more importantly, just as much, you know, read, understand history and help educate other people as well, because, you know, this is it's a long fight and you know, but the truth can't be denied forever. So, guys, you know, Jaz, Munkamal, again, thanks for your time. Once, you know, as always, you've been great. And yeah, we, you know, we'll get this episode out ASAP. But yeah, and again, to all the listeners, tune in, share our podcasts, listen to our podcasts, go onto the libraries, you know, with episode 21 now. And we've always touched on there's a massive connection between all of them. So let's not discount that. So again, thank you guys. And Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa. Waheguru Ji Ki Fateh.
Welcome to the Sikh Network Podcast, a weekly podcast discussing current and topical issues affecting Sikhs across the global diaspora.